But then came Michael Saylor and Strategy and Bitcoin, and they developed a new category of treasury asset, which is a publicly listed credit instrument that has monthly dividends, so very low effective duration, daily liquidity, and a yield that's materially higher than not only the rate of monetary debasement, which is important, but also every other alternative out there. I think we're witnessing the birth of a premier treasury reserve asset. It's finding product market fit. It's very clear. And today the trading volume is over 500 million, which is well more, it's more than the S&P 500 does in a day. So that's how fast this thing is developing. I think it is important to focus on the fundamentals when you're in this correction. I was looking at the fundamentals and the fiscal picture was improving and Bitcoin hash rate was crashing and all these regulators were coming down with all these restrictions. So that would be worse, but that's not what we're seeing right now. It's better monetary technology than gold due to its digital nature and then its absolute fixed supply. And also Bitcoin represents an asymmetric opportunity because there's so much information asymmetry around it. It's such a smaller asset by market cap that compared to gold, theoretically, Bitcoin should have outsized returns as its adoption grows just because of the relative size. It's not surprising to me to see gold perform well, but I think over the long period of time, because of Bitcoin's characteristics, it is likely to outperform.
Welcome back to Over the Horizon, a Bitcoin podcast. Today, I'm joined by Sam Callahan. Last time he was on the show, I think it was about a year ago. He's now the Director of Strategy and Research at Orange BTC, which is Latin America's largest Bitcoin treasury company. Sam, how's it going, man?
Great, Joe. Great. How are you?
Yeah. I'm doing well. Lots of stuff going on, namely Stretch. We were talking a little bit before we pressed the record button, but this week they've estimated to have purchased 10,215 BTC in climbing, which is 3.2 times the weekly supply issuance for Bitcoin, and it's not even the end of the day on Thursday yet. So what on earth is happening here, and what's your take on Stretch as a product and how significant it is?
Well, I think it's extremely significant. I think we're witnessing the birth of a premier treasury reserve asset. It's finding product market fit. It's very clear. I mean, the volume has been crazy. So yesterday, I posted kind of an overview of why Orange BTC became the first public company to allocate to Stretch on our balance sheet. We announced it at Strategy World 2026. And I kind of went over it and I had data that were in those slides that looked at the average daily trading volume. And it was like a little bit over 135. And I think today that's 173. So that's how fast this thing's developing. And today the trading volume is over 500 million, which is well more, it's more than the S&P 500 does in a day. So we're seeing product market fit. And why that is because when you compare Stretch to other traditional alternatives out there for a treasure, whether that's T-bills, money market funds, commercial paper, bank accounts, like where do you hold your cash as a corporate treasurer? Where do you hold it? And there's always been this structural bind that treasurers are in, which is that a lot of these instruments provide relative stability and liquidity, but they don't outperform the rate of monetary debasement, which is around 6%. And so you erode value, your cash just loses value. But you kind of make that trade-off for the stability and some liquidity. And if you want to go out on the and get more yield on your cash, you have to go into riskier assets or more illiquid assets, which is an ideal. But then came Michael Saylor and Strategy and Bitcoin, and they developed a new category of treasury asset, which is a publicly listed credit instrument that has monthly dividends, so very low effective duration, daily liquidity, and a yield that's materially higher than not only the rate of monetary debasement, which is important, but also every other alternative out there. And so when we saw it, we were like, we're going to do this because not only do we feel comfortable, obviously, with like existential Bitcoin risk, like long-term Bitcoin risk. We're a Bitcoin treasury company. Like we're very comfortable with the Bitcoin risk involved with STRC, but also we're comfortable with the corporate credit risk, which is Strategy as the issuer. And we're comfortable with that risk because of the capital structure that they've engineered and their massive Bitcoin balance sheet that's backing this 11.5% effective yield. And so, you know, I'll stop there, but that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it. And I think the market awareness of this product is growing and the liquidity is deepening. And that only reinforces the stability of the product itself when there's more demand. And so you can see this kind of reflexive flywheel happening. And it's really exciting. I think this week and the last couple of weeks, we've really seen Stretch and STRC adoption accelerate. I think it's good for strategy. It's good for the business model, like proving the business model. And it's good for Bitcoin because, as you mentioned, like the demand for Bitcoin right now, just from Stretch alone. What did you say? What was the stat you said in terms of?
Yeah, so it's 324% or 3.2x the current weekly issuance of Bitcoin. And it's not even the end of the week yet, which is, it's pretty incredible. And to me, I remember Dylan put out a tweet like last June or last July, just before Stretch was announced, one of the other preferred stocks has been announced. And he said that the short leg of the perpetual futures market has found Bitcoin. Basically, what he was trying to get at there was that this entire market that you have, the fixed income market globally, income-seeking investors, institutional investors who park their idle capital in these yield-bearing instruments, typically they scale into those investments during harder times, during less risk-on times, more risk-averse times. But with Stretch, you've kind of got an interesting mechanic where those same investors who are scaling up their fixed income investments because times are more risk-off, Strategy is using the proceeds of that to fully port it into Bitcoin. And so in a way, now they've engineered this solution where it sort of puts a floor underneath Bitcoin's price when there's a risk-off environment. Right now, the S&P 500 has had a very difficult time over the last month and a half. It's sort of forming this rounding top here. It seems like equities are going to be tanking over the next couple of months, but Bitcoin is $10,000 off of its local low. And so it seems, in a way, all of this is to say that they've sort of engineered a solution where they have indirectly made it so that folks who are buying fixed income products during harder times, when they scale up those investments, it actually is really great for Bitcoin. So it almost puts a floor underneath Bitcoin's price, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, on the margin, it provides more incremental demand really across the entire cycle for Bitcoin, right? I mean, people are going to want a steady stream of income that's durable and liquid when Bitcoin's in a raging bull market and when it's in a bear market. And so it is providing that demand for Bitcoin at a time where it probably needs it, right? Where, you know, you kind of need that structural bid. And now that I think that bid's just going to grow as STRC adoption grows and more people understand what's behind this yield and why it's very different than, say, like a junk bond yield, a comparable high-yield credit instrument. You know, you kind of see like some of these structural bids across the market. Another one's Tether. Every quarter, Tether has said that it's going to invest 15% of its net operating profits into Bitcoin, regardless of the price. So you got a price-insensitive buyer there. And the other one was Binance announcing their, you know, $1 billion insurance fund. And they said that they would top it up to $1 billion each time, which means if Bitcoin's price falls, they're going to be a buyer to kind of top that back up to a billion. And so that's three. That's three large price insensitive buyers. And strategies is, I mean, it's crazy how big this thing can scale if it continues to gain adoption like it is. I mean, we've talked about this all the time in terms of how large the fixed income market is and how it's not really, you know, Jeff Fulton always says, risk is mispriced. Mm-hmm. And to me, what I kind of think about with that is you have this idea that like T-bills and treasury bonds are quote unquote risk-free. And I think people so broadly view it like that. You have people kind of viewing that as risk-free and then completely over-exaggerating Bitcoin risk at the same time. Yeah. And so that difference, that mispricing of risk in Bitcoin and then in traditional credit instruments, that's what provides like a tremendous amount of opportunity for issuers of this digital credit products, people building on top of the digital credit products, as well as for everybody that just wants some fixed income that's, like I said, durable and liquid, low duration. I mean, it kind of checks the box for everything you'd want in terms of a full credit profile as a corporate treasurer. Or anybody running any CFO running a public company. So yeah, we're at the very, very early stages of this, but it's very, very exciting. I'm pumped about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really cool as well. Strive announced they also purchased a Stretch allocation, I think $50 million worth of Stretch. So now you have treasury companies who are extremely long Bitcoin choosing instead of parking their cash in solely cash and T-bills, they're also choosing an allocation of Stretch, which is really cool. And yeah. Then, you know, one more thing I'll say as far as like risk is concerned and the mispricing of risk, the reason we call treasuries all across the curve risk-free is because there's this notion that's been long held, which is that the United States is not going to default on its debt. But in actuality, we've been defaulting on our debt at an increasing rate for years, right? We just haven't been doing it explicitly. We've been doing it out the back door in the more shady way, which is monetary debasement. And so if we're actually comparing these two things, apples to apples, the reality is like you can't print your way out of some sort of distress situation in Bitcoin. Its monetary schedule is completely fixed, whereas it's not the case for the US Treasury. And so the reality is that like risk is completely mispriced here because the way that we've been giving the risk-free moniker to the United States is Treasury is totally misaligned.
Yeah, and I'll say like one thing, which is, you know, we got like some pushback in terms of, you know, why is a Bitcoin treasury company buying Stretch? Mm-hmm. And I think people just need to understand that as a public operating company, we have fiat denominated obligations, you know, mm-hmm. just like vendors, taxes. So we hold liquidity buffers both in real and in US dollars. And so, you know, Bitcoin's still our primary reserve asset. It's still our mission to accumulate more Bitcoin and create a way for our shareholders and build our Bitcoin holdings. But we're always going to hold some fiat liquidity buffers to manage those liabilities and those expenses that we have. And so then it just came down to not that if we were going to hold some cash, it's what do we do with it? And so that's the thing. And then we were holding, you know, earning low single digit yields. And we have this product that we believe in, that's digital credit. And we decided to be a first mover in that because not all those characteristics that I already talked about, but also, you know, by buying Stretch, you know, we're basically buying Stretch and then Strategy can go buy Bitcoin. And so we're actually driving demand for the asset that we're building our entire company around, yeah. as opposed to buying a T-bill or putting it in a money market fund. You know, we are literally structuring our balance sheet all around Bitcoin. And so if we're going to, you know, hold cash, we might well as well hold it in a, you know, cash-like instrument that supports the very asset that we're trying to drive adoption for. And so it made sense. There's like this really interesting flywheel effect with Stretch. You know, if you really think about it, it's like Strategy issues more Stretch. They buy Bitcoin. On the margin, that helps support Bitcoin price. You know, by supporting the Bitcoin price and driving demand for more Bitcoin, we talked about how much Bitcoin they're buying. That improves their balance sheet, which increases their balance sheet capacity. By increasing their balance sheet capacity as well as strengthening their balance sheet, that improves the creditworthiness of Stretch or the mm-hmm. perceived stability, which drives demand for Stretch, which allows them to issue more Stretch. It's this positive flywheel effect. And so by just being, you know, a holder of Stretch, we're kind of helping that flywheel go. But, you know, it seems like right now that the entire market's waking up to that and that flywheel's humming in a way that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, it's insane. Like if you take a look at the volume profile, we went from doing relatively okay, like mostly under $100 million to the last 3 days, we've done like 250 million, 400 million, over 500 million. It's not even 4 p.m. Eastern yet, right? So it really is amazing to see. And it's kind of a no-brainer, right? Like lots of people are saying Michael Saylor is going to be the richest man in the world over the next decade or two. I tend to ascribe to that as well, because more folks are waking up to the reality of this perpetual monetary debasement that we're facing. Fixed income investors have mandates that preclude them from investing in BTC, but they're more than happy to invest in a fixed income product that's yielding 11.5% with return on capital. And on the flip side of the equation, those who don't have mandates to hold fixed income products, they're more than happy to buy BTC. So the strength of folks buying BTC increases Strategy's creditworthiness, driving more demand for Stretch. They use those proceeds to purchase BTC. It really is quite an amazing flywheel that that they've constructed here. I want to shift gears away from that because there's also a pretty major development as far as Bitcoin is concerned. Not necessarily from like a day-to-day standpoint, but from a multi-decade standpoint. And that's that the 20 millionth Bitcoin was mined just 2 days ago, I believe. Pretty cool milestone. Only 1 million BTC roughly left to be mined over the next 114 years. What are your thoughts on this and the significance of this event that just passed?
Well, I mean, I'm always applauding Bitcoin milestones, like anything that speaks to Bitcoin's track record and resilience. And it's just amazing that this like set issuance schedule is just programmed and kind of fixed in stone, and it's some kind of level of certainty that the world can center around in a very uncertain world. And so we have TikTok next block, you know, 20th Bitcoin mined, and then it just really speaks to the scarcity, right? Which I think people still aren't waking up to the scarcity. I mean, not to bring it back to strategy, but it's like I read some tweet that said, you know, why isn't somebody following Michael Saylor? And I'm like, well, there's not that much Bitcoin out there. Like, it's really hard to catch Michael Saylor at this point, as well as there's not that much conviction out there. Like, what strategy is expressing with their actions. And so really it speaks to the scarcity, the fixed scarcity of Bitcoin. There's only 1 million left all the way to 2140 or around there. And, you know, get some while you can. You know, I think there's another tweet that showed, you know, a quote from Saylor in 2020 about how once you understand Bitcoin, I'm paraphrasing, but once you understand Bitcoin, you're anxious because you want to get as much as you can before everybody else. But I think every Bitcoiner goes through that. Once the light bulb clicks, you start to understand the scarcity of this thing and the opportunity that exists because, I mean, when it comes down to it, there's only going to be 21 million. You look through that Bitcoin lens and you look at the fiat world and, you know, the supply on that side of things is infinity, basically. And so to contrast the two is always powerful. And so what do you think about it, though? Curious.
I mean, it's pretty sweet. I put out a tweet about it like a week ago or a week before it happened when I was like not on a lot of people's radars because I had recalled that we were approaching the target and put out the tweet and Jack Dorsey liked it, which is pretty cool.
That is cool.
Founder of the platform liking the post. But I think it's hugely significant because when you think of Bitcoin relative to other assets, and I'm thinking of gold because it's the closest real world analog that has been the beneficiary of the Lindy effect for hundreds and thousands of years. When you think about gold, it's interesting. You think, okay, we've got X amount of tons dredged up from the earth. Whenever gold's price rises massively, there's this supply effect where producers look at the price of gold closer to $5,000 than a couple of years ago when it was at $2,000. And they go, okay, you know, all of these sites, let's say 30% of the sites that we own, which previously weren't profitable to begin mining at, now they are profitable to start mining at. So we're going to go mine from those sites. And that's going to naturally depress the price of gold because it's going to increase the supply. With Bitcoin, all economics are fundamentally broken regardless of how high the price goes because there is no supply response function to price. Satoshi broke all economic models when he decided to do that. Obviously, in the near term, there is, but the difficulty adjustment is really Bitcoin's killer app as far as the supply schedule is concerned. And so to me, trying to wrap my head around it, more importantly, trying to teach other people about this, it becomes extremely difficult because it goes against all of the normal laws of economics when we think about scarcity, whereas real estate is relatively scarce, gold is relatively scarce, Bitcoin is absolutely scarce. And so hitting this milestone is substantial, but not nearly as substantial as the halving that we have coming up in 2 years, which will cut the block reward from 3.125 to a little bit over 1.5, which will be incredible, completely insane to think that 2 years ago you could get 6.25 BTC per block. Now you're going to be getting, you know, 1.5. And so if you think about it, like as the days tick on, it's so important to be allocating to Bitcoin, particularly as you now see institutions coming into the fray. You see Michael Saylor posting photos at Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan and all of these other financial institutions going and meeting with them. And so like as an individual, I think I recall the Saylor tweet you were talking about. It's like an AI generated photo of him in bed, like not being able to go to sleep because of realizing, you know, the problem we have at hand and how valuable Bitcoin is. It just kind of brings all of those things to mind once more that we're at 20 million, like, oh my goodness, right? There are seven figures worth of BTC left to be mined and that's it forever, right? Yeah. No, it's a really interesting time.
Yeah. And it's interesting time because we're currently in a period of Bitcoin where, you know, sentiment's low and it's, what is it, like 40-45% off its all-time high. And there's a lot of negative press around Bitcoin. It's failed. And then we talk about some of the dynamics of institutional adoption, you know, Bitcoin scarcity, and these fundamentals that just seem to be, they've wildly improved over the last 12 months. I mean, it's like I've never seen before since I've been tracking Bitcoin. And you see this divergence in the price right now. And it's just, these are the kind of, if you're a long-term investor, you know, these are the kind of entry points that I think you dream of.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this speaks to a post that you had made, I think it was about a month and a half ago, mid or late January, where you talked about the four market divergences that you were looking at. And one of them was precious metals doing extremely well while Bitcoin had decoupled from global M2. And Bitcoin has sort of been pretty strongly decoupled from global M2 since late last summer. So what's your take on that? Why is Bitcoin struggling so much and sort of falling alongside the software stocks, despite Bitcoin's fundamentals only improving and precious metals catching a tremendous bid here as monetary expansion continues?
Yeah, I think that's kind of multifaceted. The first one with global M2, it's my position that there's periods where the relationship starts to break down when supply side dynamics override global liquidity conditions as the main price driver. And as well as when there's like idiosyncratic events specific to the broader crypto industry that causes, you know, decoupling to occur or a divergence to occur from its long-term correlation to global M2. And so I think that happened. I think it happened in early October with the huge deleveraging event that occurred, that cascade, the $20 billion. You just look at any of the charts comparing Bitcoin to the S&P 500 or NASDAQ and how it just kind of like just completely decoupled from all other risk assets after that event. And that was specific to the crypto industry. And so I think liquidity and sentiment has been steadily rebuilding since then, but we still haven't really fully recovered from it. And so I think that's part of the reason why it's decoupled, you know, because even before that happened, people forget, like everyone was talking about gold outperformance, but Bitcoin was at an all-time high like 3 days before that. And it was like 15% off gold, you know, and we know how Bitcoin moves, like 15% isn't that crazy to happen in 1 week with Bitcoin. So, but it went the other way where there was this huge deleveraging event. And then suddenly, you know, it looks like gold's crushing Bitcoin over the last, you know, 3 months because of that internal market dynamics that occurred. So I think that's part of it. And the other side is the supply side dynamics, which, I mean, a lot of people have talked about this, but there's a lot of on-chain evidence that some quote unquote OGs have been taking profits and selling. I think that's definitely happening. I think there's some selling pressure from long-term holders who are taking some profits, living their lives. That's what savings are for. That's what money's for. And they've benefited from being early adopters to Bitcoin. And if they want to buy a lake house and they want to, you know, buy some diversification, you know, that's what savings are for. And it's kind of a good thing to see dispersion occur in Bitcoin. And so I think that played into factors as well in terms of the decoupling from global M2. You had supply side factors and large amounts of spot selling from OGs. But that's always temporary in nature. Eventually, there's consolidation and the Bitcoin moves from people who want to sell now or speculators or traders to more convicted long-term holders. And that's what sets the floor each cycle. And each cycle, the floor has been materially higher than the last one. And so I've said this before, but I just imagine like these people have to exist all over the world, which is like men and women who came to Bitcoin, you know, last year or over the last 2 years, and they had that light bulb moment that we talked about with Michael Saylor in bed being like, oh my gosh, I need to get as much Bitcoin as I can. You know, I figured this out. This thing's so scarce and it's so cool. But they get really sad because they feel like they missed it, right? When Bitcoin's at all-time highs at 126, they're like, oh man, like I should have, why didn't I read about this 5 years ago? Everybody's had this thought like, oh,
do you think unit bias is a headwind to adoption? Because that's one thing that I've been thinking, you know, when you see the price of an asset at 126 grand, obviously it's common knowledge to you and I that Bitcoin is divisible into 100 million units. It's common knowledge to a lot of people that you don't have to buy one full share of a stock anymore. You can buy fractional shares, basically every single broker that anybody would have their retirement account on. But do you think seeing the price at 70 grand is something that prevents people from wanted to take a stab at it, or do you think that it's something else?
Maybe a little bit. I think that comes with like, you know, financial illiteracy a little bit. It's like just because I, you know, a piece of gold is really expensive doesn't mean I want to buy a ton of fool's gold just because there's more of it. So, you know, I think the unit bias is a fallacy. But kind of what I was getting at is for the people that just learned about Bitcoin, though, didn't just like buy it and wish they had more, but learned about it, you feel kind of depressed that you didn't get into it earlier. But now that the price is corrected, I just know there's people out there with conviction now who are so excited to be buying this dip, who have their calculators out like, oh my gosh, I can get one Bitcoin. So they're selling things. They're taking on that extra shift. They're doing a part-time job, hustling to acquire sats at these levels. And that's what the that's what sets the floor, you know, the move to convicted holders. And they're taking advantage of this dip. And there's a new wave of convicted hodlers that are coming in right now all around the world. And so where that level is, if it's, you know, the bottom was 58 and 60, or, you know, I could see that. There was a pretty terrible sentiment at the time. And, you know, or could some macro, if we see a 15% decline in equities, could we see Bitcoin kind of test those levels again? I'm like, yeah, of course. But at the same time, I think that this is what you typically see near bottoms for each cycle, this kind of behavior, this kind of sentiment. And so it makes me kind of optimistic for the next, you know, 1 to 2 years.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. The only thing missing from this bottom, at least so far, right? I don't want to, you know, jinx anything, but the last bull market, we saw 3R's Capital, Celsius, FTX, all of those things, all of those shops explode. I think there is a lot more caution as far as overseas lending platforms and bucket shops are concerned. But that said, that's one of the things that's missing from this cycle. And I think absent those things, Bitcoin may have already found its bottom. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, Bitcoin tends to move out ahead of the broader risk market. So it tends to move out and ahead and make the move before the S&P 500 and NASDAQ do. And so that could very well be what happened here. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
Speaking about, oh, go ahead.
Well, you kind of mentioned the divergence with gold.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I right now, like if Bitcoin didn't exist, I would own a lot of gold. I think gold's not a bad place to have your money.
Yeah.
It's a hard, scarce asset. It's relatively scarce. It's also has what you said, a very long Lindy effect. And people view it as a safe haven asset. You don't have to teach them what gold is. Large pools of capital, like the big money, institutional investors, central banks, they're more likely to turn to gold as a neutral reserve asset than Bitcoin today. Mm-hmm. So it's not like shocking to me to see gold perform well. I just think that really when it comes down to Bitcoin, you're betting that Bitcoin's better technology. It's better monetary technology than gold due to its digital nature and then its absolute fixed supply. And also Bitcoin represents an asymmetric opportunity because there's so much information asymmetry around it. It's such a smaller asset by market cap that, you know, compared to gold, theoretically, Bitcoin should have outsized returns as its adoption grows just because of the relative size. So being early to any new technology comes with a lot of asymmetric upside, but it also takes a lot of patience because, you know, the whole world's still wrapping their heads around this thing and they're kind of going to stumble over themselves. They're going to misunderstand it, mislabel it, seek alternatives that might not have superior monetary characteristics. But for those who have the conviction and do the work and have the patience to withstand the volatility, they're likely to be rewarded for understanding it before the majority. And so I think that's where we are right now. So it's not surprising to me to see gold perform well. But I think over the long period of time, because of Bitcoin's characteristics, it is likely to outperform. And that's the bet, you know, and time will tell.
Time, in fact, will tell. And also, you know, from the perspective of the world becoming more uncertain in 2026, obviously a new war is now broken out. I think one of the more slept upon aspects of Bitcoin, a lot of folks will get into the asset for number go up. I know I certainly did, but it's its portability, not just its superior supply schedule and its superior scarcity to gold, but also its portability. You know, if you're fleeing the Middle East or you're fleeing, you know, one of these nations, it's going to cost quite a bit of money for you to bring your 100 gold bars with you relative to, you know, bringing a USB stick in your pocket.
Yeah.
And so I think that's particularly if war continues escalating, if more wars break out, that certainly could be one component of Bitcoin that is much more favorable and is an investable reason.
Yeah,
to get into the asset.
I couldn't agree more. And I think some of the traits that Bitcoiners have been talking about for years with Bitcoin in terms of its permissionlessness and censorship resistance, that's, I think, going to become more appreciated by a wider majority over time. because I think you're going to see more weaponization of the fiat system, more capital controls, more censorship. And that those usually go hand in hand with rising currency debasement and inflation and conflict.
Yeah.
And so I think those traits of Bitcoin are going to get more and more appreciated over time. And you want to be careful because you want to have compassion. You know, there's more important things than markets and money in events like this. You know, you're thinking about the people on the ground and the loss of life and all that stuff. But as Bitcoiners, it's hard not to look at things like that and say, like, you know, this is one of the reasons why Bitcoin has a quote unquote use case. If people keep saying, oh, it has no use case. Okay. Well, last year, if you had a house and you had a wildfire coming at you in the Palisades, you know, and you had 10 minutes to leave and you have a bunch of beautiful art on the wall and all the jewelry and everything, you know, really collectible cars, you know, the real estate itself, you know, how do you store your wealth? And then if you have 10 minutes to gather everything, you start to understand maybe why having part of your wealth in a digital asset that you can have with 12 words in your head is useful. And, you know, especially when you talk about, you know, the insurance claims, the mess that that's been in terms of actually getting your value back of what your collectibles and all your art and all that was worth. I mean, you're probably not going to get that, right? So, you know, the same thing, if bombs start falling from the sky, we saw this in the Russia-Ukraine conflict as well. There was multiple reports of people using Bitcoin to leave and flee war-torn areas with a portion of their wealth. And that's, you know, for anybody that's gone through that, like, I'm fortunate I haven't had to go through that, but I know people who have. And they say that that can be life-changing because I've had people who've had to flee and they couldn't take anything with them. And then they have to start completely over. And that just sounds so much harder than being able to at least flee with some of your wealth if you have it with 12 words in your head or, like you said, a hardware wallet. The odds of you getting across the border with authorities with like a bag full of gold, you know. And then, you know, I don't know if you saw I love Mr. Beast did some video like maybe last year or 2 years ago where he's running with bags of cash, you know, like different, it says like 10,000, 50,000, 100,000. And by a million, it's just like this giant bag, you know, he's trying to run with. Mm-hmm. And then you think about that was dollars. And think about like the inflating, you know, currency in Iran. Like, I don't even know how many bags you would have of cash to try to leave with anything remotely, you know, that represented your wealth. Like it would be impossible. You'd have to stuff your entire car and then try to get around with it. So yeah, man, I couldn't agree more. You got to like approach that a little delicately because, like I said, you want to be like compassionate about the loss of life and all that stuff, but. You're just trying to help people because you know that this could potentially happen in the future with another conflict, and people should learn about this. And you know, people who have used Bitcoin and they're fleeing these countries, I mean, they should voice that and say like, hey, this actually helped me, so that people understand the usefulness of this technology.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And one of the charts that you have in your post, which is really great, is comparing the S&P 500 gold and Bitcoin through these major geopolitical events in 60 days following all of these different conflicts, whether it's COVID, whether it's the regional banking crisis we saw in 2023, whether it's Liberation Day, Bitcoin is the best performing asset 2 months after each of those events. So it remains to be seen where we'll be in 2 months as far as Bitcoin is from a price perspective.
Well, it's kind of it's pretty resilient right now. With the escalation of the war, I mean, I think right now Bitcoin's outperforming since when things started to really escalate with the U.S. getting involved. We'll see if it happens. It always made sense to me with like the tariff announcements, outbreak of war, like why a neutral, permissionless monetary network or, you know, asset that's neutral, that's resistant to debasement would perform well. In the initial fear of the news, everything kind of correlates to one and falls and Bitcoin gets dragged into that. But then when you actually think about, oh, wait, tariffs, like any weaponization of the traditional financial system or payment system should boost the value proposition of an alternative monetary system that's permissionlessness, you would think, right? Same thing with war, the things that we talked about. The other thing with war is that I've said many times that there's two certainties with war. It's that, you know, they're inflationary and they're destructive. And They're inflationary because governments spend, wars are expensive. And then wars disrupt supply chains is what we're seeing right now with the spike in oil and commodity prices going haywire. The disruption in global trade and supply chains causes scarcity in commodities, and that trickles out in the economy in terms of rising inflation. And then the governments are spending more. Like Trump just a couple months ago said that they're going to increase the defense budget by $500 million, $1.4 trillion, at a time where we're already running these massive deficits. And that's, yeah, this is kind of, people talk about why Bitcoin failed, but let me grab something real quick.
No, you got it.
I got this thing by the door. It's, you know, the national debt.
Yeah.
The debt clock that Thomas Massey.
That's awesome.
This is going to go up. You know, this is all that really matters when you talk about like Bitcoin. Nothing's changed with the fiat system, the unsustainable outlook of the fiscal picture.
Yeah.
And these deficits, when you have outbreaks of war, it gets worse. So like most of the spending that's going to happen in the U.S. over the next 10 years, it's like 90% are going to be the entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Interest expense is supposed to double, mm-hmm. right? And then you have the defense. And now Trump's talking about, you know, we have escalation of conflicts, and then Trump's talking about increasing it by $500 billion. And that's like, this is all that matters. This is why, like, you know, the reason for owning an asset that is resistant against debasement. I mean, this is, you just need to buy one of these to remind yourself, put it next to
it. Because it's really the only way out. And you mentioned in another post, speaking specifically about mandatory spending, that the next couple of years, we're going to hit peak 65, meaning that we're about to experience the largest wave of beneficiaries, entitlement beneficiaries in history. So you have an aging population who will no longer be a part of the tax base at the same time that you have the military budget doubling, interest expense doubling over the next decade, and a generation of people who are not having children specifically because of how expensive everything is.
Yeah,
that's not going to be a tax base that's sufficient to pay for all of this stuff, right? And so what you have to do inevitably is borrow, and increasingly so with freshly printed money.
Yeah, exactly. And so you're starting to hear, you know, if you just, like you said, if you have patience and if any of these things changed, if I felt like, you know, maybe that would be bad for Bitcoin's long-term value proposition. But it's actually getting worse. Like this is getting worse. I can't like the camera. This is getting worse. And like what you said, you know, hitting peak 65 and every single year, the spending on Medicare and Medicaid is increasing because not only of those dynamics of people becoming eligible for them, but also because of like the fraud. That was like a big story, right? The last couple years, there's a tremendous amount of fraud in Medicaid and Medicare, and they don't even know why. There's some of the reasons why the bills are coming in so much higher, right? It's just like it's a complete bureaucratic mess. That's why focusing on what I say, the fundamentals, it's like Bitcoin adoption side of things. And then like the fiat, degradation, like the fiat, long-term unsustainability of the fiat system is the other fundamentals. And they're both pointing towards why you'd want to hold Bitcoin, in my opinion, over a long period of time.
Absolutely. So speaking specifically about the fundamentals, what are some of the things that you're seeing on the horizon that are encouraging to you? Like when you see the fundamentals have improved, what specifically are you looking at? Are we talking about hash rate, regulation, obviously a bunch of developments there, institutional adoption, what Square did a couple of months ago is pretty incredible. So what are the big things on your mind as far as the fundamentals are concerned?
I mean, all the above, everything that what you just said. I mean, I think the change in the regulatory environment was substantial, and that just opens the door for large financial institutions and large institutional investors to feel comfortable allocating and building. And it's really about like accessibility and education when it comes down to it. Once you get over, you know, the existential Bitcoin risk of like, is Bitcoin going to work? Is Bitcoin going to be around? Let's just like move past that for a second and say like, okay, Bitcoin is the real deal. This is a groundbreaking technology. It's going to be around forever. Mm-hmm. Let's just like move past that and say like, what's the actual issue here? Well, it's accessibility and it's education. And so now when you have the Morgan Stanleys of the world building, the city coming in, sovereign wealth funds, like Kazakhstan Central Bank. Like, there's, we're in the very early stages of that penetration. It's like they're going to build products and services that allow their clients to feel comfortable allocating to this asset class. And, you know, people care about the credibility and the name recognition. You know, they trust their financial, a lot of people use financial advisors, and a lot of them like work with Morgan Stanley's like wealth management division, right? And when you have like a, somebody who works there that you trust for the last 15 years, finally saying like, you know, Bitcoin might be a good, because they've learned about it, because from the top down, they're having initiatives to build Bitcoin products and services. And so now all their financial advisors are getting up to speed about what Bitcoin is. You know, now they're teaching their clients. And then suddenly like the education level around Bitcoin is rising. And it matters when it's coming from Black. Unfortunately, it matters when it's coming from BlackRock and it's coming from Morgan Stanley. I mean, that's just, you know, living in reality of how a lot of people think. You know, I wish they listened to like the Bitcoiners 5 to 10 years ago, but sometimes they just need the right messenger to deliver the message. And so I just see the education and the accessibility of Bitcoin accelerating like crazy. And I think some of it is related to these digital credit products. I mean, it's really just taking Bitcoin and then removing the volatility and kind of packaging it up differently to fit different cohorts of investors' risk tolerance levels, as well as their financial goals, as well as the investment mandates. And so you're just kind of like putting Bitcoin products and flavors into every single nook and cranny of the financial system. And as those products grow in popularity and market awareness, and they start to educate themselves about what those are, that's just going to keep driving to the underlying. And you got the ETFs, and you got, you know, it's, you know, and then the, like on the payment side of things, it's all together, right? Like Bitcoin adoption is multifaceted by region and by use case. And so to see what Jack Dorsey and Block is doing, and what Square is doing with the merchant adoption, like that's awesome. Like it's all good for Bitcoin. Like there's like people are using Bitcoin for different reasons. Like any other revolutionary technology that affects every part of the world and every company, you know, people are using this for different reasons. And so you're seeing the adoption grow and people build. You know, if Jack Dorsey like is very passionate about, you know, Bitcoin's use as a medium exchange and for payments and as peer-to-peer cash, like great, like build on that. Like keep doing what you're doing. Like it's good for Bitcoin. And I think what Michael Saylor is doing is also good for Bitcoin, because he's just attacking a different part of it and driving adoption in a different way, which is, you know, financial engineering Bitcoin, delivering Bitcoin-backed products that fit into certain investment mandates that will never use Bitcoin like for peer-to-peer payments. You know, that's just not what they do. Like, it's not what a fixed income investment fund will do, but they will buy Stretch. And that's good for Bitcoin too. And so I just see this kind of all going at the same time. It's all good for Bitcoin. And that's why I say the fundamentals are improving. But, you know, that's my thoughts. What's yours, Joe? And I respect what you think too.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Like in times like these and in all of the time, frankly, price is the least interesting part about Bitcoin. The real building tends to happen during bear markets, right? You know, it's not all that long ago that Stretch launched. Obviously, it launched while we were still in the bull market. But right now, the fact that Bitcoin is at $70,000 and the biggest news as far as my X feed is concerned is this fixed income product that's built atop Bitcoin that strips away the volatility and is appealing to an entirely different cohort of investors in spot BTC. It's just amazing, right? You know, to think that we would have structured Bitcoin credit products a couple of years ago, to think that that would be the biggest story in Bitcoin instead of some crypto scam located in the Bahamas or whatever. It's really amazing to see how far we've come, right? You know, the fact that Strategy is going and taking meetings with Morgan Stanley, and I see Jeff Walton making posts about how he's in New York talking to a bunch of different insurance companies about digital credit. It truly is amazing how far we've come, and a lot of people will rag on the institution, but that's just the reality of an asset that is monetizing. You have to package this in different ways to appeal to different cohorts of people if Bitcoin is to soak up a lot of the monetary premium that's currently present in this $1 quadrillion market. Not all $1 quadrillion worth of that value is going to be able to buy spot Bitcoin and hold it in self-custody, right? And so I just love everything that I'm seeing as far as the new products are concerned, as far as Square's integration with merchants is concerned. It's just an amazing time to be in the Bitcoin space.
Yeah, and like... Look, I mean, you said it well. Nothing's going to replace spot Bitcoin held in self-custody. I mean, in terms of risks, like, I mean, I think nothing can really compete with that in terms of stripping away risks, taking a sovereignty of your wealth, like all those things that we love about Bitcoin and self-custody. But the point is that, like, some people don't either want that or they can't. And so now we're just, like, delivering Bitcoin in different forms that either fits their needs or they literally can do it now because, you know, they had restrictions before about holding spot Bitcoin. So I don't think like these things replace spot Bitcoin is what I'm saying. And I think there's definitely a place for spot Bitcoin held in self-custody in everyone's portfolio. And I'll always advocate for that. But I'll also advocate for Bitcoin-backed securities because I think it's all accretive to Bitcoin adoption. And it's actually driving things forward. It's a good time, man. It's a good time to be building. For sure. It's exciting time. You feel like the barriers are down. There's still work to be done, right? Mm-hmm. It's still, you know, there's still like, there are still barriers that exist. A lot of them are down. It doesn't feel like the regulators are fighting us as much. But, you know, for instance, like the de minimis exemption, like that's a fight right now. Like we could advocate for. It makes sense. It's always made sense to me that Bitcoin shouldn't be taxed the way it is for payments. That's a battle. The Basel rules are a battle. But I think over time, like Bitcoin will just continue to bring those barriers down as Bitcoin adoption grows and there's large players that build businesses around it and products and services, like they'll start to advocate for these things and they'll kind of join in on the choir of Bitcoin and supporting Bitcoin and driving adoption forward as they kind of start to learn about why it matters and they start to have financial incentives to support it as well. And so The war is not over. You know, there's still always things to fight for in Bitcoin to bring it everywhere and to just lower as many barriers as possible. But the amount of progress that this industry has made due to the hard work of Bitcoiners over the last decade, it's kind of phenomenal. And I just love being a part of it, just playing a tiny role.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. We're all working for the Bitcoin marketing department in one way or another.
Yeah.
Of which, speaking of building things, we haven't even touched on Orange BTC. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about that with whatever time we've got left here. But what are you guys currently building over there and what are you most excited about?
Well, so we are an education company. So we're building different educational products and content around Bitcoin for Brazil and in Portuguese. There's a big bit of a void there when it comes to Bitcoin education materials. So we have that arm of the business that we're driving forward. We purchased bitcoin.com.br, pretty prime digital real estate. So we're going to make that into a Bitcoin hub of content and education, eventually, you know, some products and services on that website. And so we're building that out. But we're focused on, you know, bringing these Bitcoin-backed credit products and to this market. And there's a lot of different ways to go about doing that. And I wish I could share more, but we're hard at work behind the scenes trying to drive Bitcoin adoption. There is a huge also void in just Bitcoin infrastructure there. There's just, when you compare it to the US in terms of all the different products and services available to a Bitcoiner holding Bitcoin, it's very different in Brazil. And there's a huge opportunity for somebody to build some of the products and services that exist here or there with the same kind of institutional grade professionalism. And Orange BTC is kind of well positioned to be a leader there, just given our being a public company, having a large Bitcoin balance sheet. We've always had a thesis that there's local players in that market, large financial institutions, the banking industry there is very large. They are going to want to get into Bitcoin, similar to what we're seeing in the US, but they're going to want a partner who has subject matter expertise, basically, and who understands Bitcoin. And then at the same time, there's going to be international companies who want to expand into Brazil and who also want a local partner who has the relationships there, knowledge of the regulatory environment, and can help them navigate that. So Orange BTC is kind of well positioned. We're kind of in the middle there. And that was a thesis going into this. And we've seen that. And we've been public for about 5 months. And so we've been focused on kind of getting some of that stuff out the door. And hopefully over the next quarter or two, we'll have some really interesting announcements that the market will get excited about. But when you're working behind closed doors, unfortunately, as a public company, there's only so much I could say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's exciting. I'm excited. And so hopefully I could share more in the next couple months.
That's exhilarating, man. I'm excited to learn more. And for the viewers as well, if they want to follow your journey and Orange's journey as well, what can they do to stay up to date with everything you guys are building?
Yeah. So, I mean, you can go to orangebtc.com. We have some education materials on there. We have our treasury dashboard that has all the information up to date about our treasury operations. We have our Twitter account at orangebtc. And then my Twitter account at Sam Calla, SamCallah. And you can follow along with some of my analysis as well. But yeah, it's, you know, Latin America is just one of these regions where they need Bitcoin the most. And they're some of the most innovative people on the planet when it comes to financial services. I mean, Brazilian financial services is ahead of the US in many, many ways. So we have four of the top 10 neobanks in the world in Brazil. And so it's just kind of ripe for Bitcoin adoption. You know, there's a lot of stablecoin adoption, but there's a lot of need for Bitcoin education and Bitcoin products and services. And Orange BTC is kind of ready to help spearhead that effort.
That's exhilarating. It's awesome to see what you guys are building over there. And ultimately, we need companies doing this in every market, and particularly the markets that are underserved. So it's so cool to see what you guys are building.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, for sure, man. Before we close out here, any parting thoughts? We're recording this March 12th, 2026, almost through the first quarter of this year. Where's your head at? Any parting thoughts as far as Bitcoin, the market, or anything else in your mind is concerned?
I mean, I guess I could give some like unsolicited advice. I mean, I've been through multiple 80 plus drawdowns, you know, and I think it is important to focus on the fundamentals when you're in this correction. If this is your first time, you know, people can get very bearish at bottoms. And it's just important to focus on the long term. It's easy to say that, but really, this is a long duration asset and for long term savings. And you should just have this like long term viewpoint of Bitcoin, which is why focusing on the fundamentals is so important. If we saw, I was looking at the fundamentals, and like the fiscal picture was improving and Bitcoin hash rate was crashing and, you know, all these, you know, regulators were coming down with all these restrictions. So that would be worse, but that's not what we're seeing right now. And so it's important. It's the same thing of 2018. I just remember that so well because it was my first correction. And, you know, as a young investor then, seeing your net worth on paper down so much is not that fun. But I just remember looking at the fundamentals then and just seeing all this building happening and all these companies that are progressing forward and how everything was kind of looking good on the ground. But then you look at the price, it doesn't match. And that's actually what gave me the conviction to continue buying throughout that bear market. And so that's why I always say, like, focus on the fundamentals. It's better for your health. It also is, it's better to build conviction. And you can't borrow somebody else's conviction. Mm-hmm. You got to do it yourself. You got to put in the work. Yeah. So that's my unsolicited bear market advice.
It's fantastic.
Putting in words. Yeah.
I love it. Thanks, Sam. Yeah, no, if you find yourself looking at Bitcoin's price during a correction like this and not being able to sleep or just being extremely nervous, that's a telltale sign you got to hit the books and go build some conviction, right? Your conviction needs to be commensurate with Bitcoin's drawdowns so that way you could weather whatever storm comes about. Sam, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it, man. And we'll talk to you soon.
Anytime, Joe. Anytime. Always fun talking to you, man.
And then there's one which does nothing. The Bitcoin, something like that.
Bitcoin 17 years old. 18 years is a $2 trillion asset. And
I could care less what Bitcoin trades for.